The Achaemenid Empire lasted 208 years. The Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great lasted 231. The Roman Republic lasted 233. Romanov Russia lasted 234. Today, the United States of America is 244 years old. What happens next? Where do we go from here? What do we build out of the ashes? Hello, I'm Kenaz Filan, and these are notes from the end of time.
Hello again, and welcome to the 15th episode of Notes from the End of Time. Last week I mentioned that I am once again working on a book-length manuscript. This week I have been studying the French Revolution, so I thought it would be a good time, for me anyway, to talk about the French Revolution. And I am mainly interested in it insofar as it is the first salvo in an ongoing war, and it is the first time, so far as I can tell, in recorded history that humanity went to war with God. And there are so many parallels between the French Revolution and our current situation. I mean, that's not surprising. The roots of the philosophy, which largely drives the far left side of the equation in America and in the West, was enormously influenced by the French Revolution by way of Karl Marx. We would never have seen a Russian Revolution without the French Revolution. And so, how did the French Revolution start? Well, by the time in 1789, when the Ancien Regime is overthrown, France had been under weak and unpopular kings for 74 years. Louis XIV, the famous Sun King who built Versailles, that was the golden age of France in many ways, but it takes an awful lot of money to be the Sun King. Louis XV, who came in after Louis XIV dies in 1715, was not a Sun King. Louis XV was basically most famous for being a skirt chaser. He wasn't a particularly charismatic man. Imagine a king with Michael Dukakis's charisma and Bill Clinton's libido, and you might have some idea of what we're talking about here. He reigns for about 56 years and at least that many mistresses before he dies, and he passes the throne to Louis XVI. Now, Louis XVI inherited his father's shine, as he doesn't appear to have been quite the womanizer Louis XV was, but he was married to an Austrian princess named, who was Queen Marie Antoinette, and they didn't have any issue for the first 8 years of their marriage. That could have been because he was 15 and she was 14 when they were married, but in any event, there was a lot of speculation about the king's sexual prowess, just as there had been a lot of speculation about his father's excess of prowess. And so Louis XVI was looked upon as kind of a weak, ineffectual king. There'd been no real trust in the government for decades. It was assumed that every official and bureaucrat in the French government was corrupt, because the vast majority of them were. There wasn't a lot of confidence in the clergy. There was, like, particularly the bishops and the higher ranking members of the clergy were famous for their wealth. And there was a lot of money being spent on a lot of gold in the church. While meanwhile, the population of France had grown. I would say it was around 26 million. It was the largest, most populated country in Europe at that point. You've had a huge boom in the number of people and a huge boom in the number of poor people in rural areas and a growing number of urban poor, and you're starting to see something that, again, that big division between the rural mindset and the urban mindset. France was also getting hit with some bad harvests at this point, and they were having problems with their currency. By the time Louis XVI ascended the throne, the country was almost bankrupt. They're trying to figure out ways to finance this, ways to get the money together. And they also have to keep a lid on prices because... However, here we run into a problem. The big thing they had to watch was the price of wheat, because that's for bread. They have to keep the prices of food low for the people in the cities. But when they keep the prices of food low for people in the cities, that's good for people in the cities. It's not so good for the peasants who are working to grow these crops or working to harvest the wheat, who have to sell the wheat and live on the proceeds. For them, this is not so good at all. So you start seeing more tension there. You see in the countryside, you tend to see more of the smaller churches. You don't have as many of the extremely wealthy and extremely corrupt clergy that you saw in the bigger cities. You tended to have a more pious population than you did in the cities. You're getting the beginnings of this very strong anti-clerical movement, which is they are really, really against the clergy. And, you know, as I said, there is good reason for them with this. The church had been an enormous power in France since they put Pepin the Short on. Pepin the Short was the son of Charles Martel. That's Charles the Hammer. He was the guy who drove the Muslims out and kept them into Andalusia. And the son of Pepin was Charles the Greater, as they said in French, Charlemagne. And so the church was seen as closely connected to the nobility. And they're about 2% of France's population, but they control almost all of the wealth. And this is a really big problem. So you have a very large and growing population that doesn't really like the nobility very much. You've got a nobility that distrusts the commoners. And you've got King Louis XVI, he's 19 years old when he comes to power in 1774. He really wants to do the right thing. He starts making reforms to better the lot of the people, to better the lot of the peasants. He runs into major pushback from the nobility, has to revoke these reforms. He keeps trying this, and what winds up happening, Louis XVI just doesn't have the personality to really push this through. It also doesn't help that at this point France is effectively bankrupt, so he can't really enact a lot of these reforms. And so what he winds up with is a population that despises him and a nobility that distrusts and dislikes him. He's really, the poor guy is getting it from all sides, and he keeps trying this. Things get worse, and of course, on July 14th, 1789, the Bastille gets stormed, and we get the National Assembly, and everybody at this point wants to work for a constitutional monarchy. They don't necessarily want to get rid of King Louis. They just want to rein his power in. They want to rein in the power of the nobility. And many of them want to rein in the power of the church. The problem is, if France was difficult to manage under one ineffectual leader, it became impossible to manage under no leaders. You start getting a lot of factions forming, and you start seeing the more radical voices coming to the foreground. One of the people who rose to fame during the French Revolution was a man named Jacques Hébert. Now, Jacques had been an aspiring playwright and writer for some time. Mostly he'd failed at it. He was living in destitution until he just really hit pay dirt with his weekly pamphlet newspaper called Le Père Duchesne, or Father Duchesne. And Father Duchesne was this grumpy old stove maker who just offered his political observations on life, on the nobility, and on the clergy. And they were inevitably really profane. For example, in 1790, the Pope condemned a constitution, the civic constitution, the law that required French clergy to take an oath of loyalty to the French state in the French Revolution. The Pope banned it, and Palais Duchesne replied to the Pope, "Who does he take us for, that bastard of an indulgence seller? Does he think that with his toilet paper, his bulls, his cannons without primers, and all the thunder and idiocies which he put to sleep or scared our fathers? Fuck! Does he still believe he leads the French of today? We're no longer in the time of King Dagobert, and today we're no longer such dupes as to buy the pardons that priests trafficked in past centuries, nor to be upset by an interdiction that the Bishop of Rome will cast upon the kingdom. The hell with them! We won't let ourselves be fooled by those sons of bitches of priests. Their confessions, their purgatory, their absolutions, their indulgences are nothing but feed for the foolish. The so-called keys of St. Peter, with which the Pope's criers once opened the door to the great salon of the Eternal Father, now seem to us to be nothing but skeleton keys with which the Latin pontiff wants to pry open our houses and our coffers so as to take what we own. I can reply for the Parisians. Fuck, and our pals from the Faubourg Saint-Antoine are all disposed to fix them. I pity the bastard who will dare assume his pulpit to pronounce the excommunication they threaten us with. He can be sure it'll be only one small leap from there to the lamppost. And if the sons of bitch priests think they'll do better in the departments if they flatter themselves that the same brigands who they armed with daggers in Nimes, Montauban, and Vannes will back up their efforts, then fuck, 20,000 of us are ready to recall them to order." And every week Hébert was putting out these pamphlets. Every week there are sellers on the street yelling to the crowds, "Yo, Palais Duchesne is damn angry today," and people are just eating this up. He's very popular with the working and impoverished classes of Paris. So these are the people who are getting pinched by inflation, they're getting pinched by the rise in food prices, they can't find work, they can't feed their families, they're really, really desperate, and they're really angry, and they need somewhere to point that anger. And one of the defining features for them was they couldn't afford culottes, they couldn't afford the fancy silk breeches that the nobility or that the bourgeois could wear. All, they had pantaloons, and they'd wear this red, what became called the Phrygian cap. It was a cap that would become associated with the revolution. And they wear the sans-culottes. And the sans-culottes just ate up every word Palais Duchesne said. He told them their enemies. He told them who to hate. And before long, les sans-culottes became a mob that was essentially working at Hébert's command, and Hébert starts affiliating with some of the political parties that are trying to get to power here. Hébert becomes affiliated with the Jacobins. They're a bunch of intellectuals, mostly middle to class, with a smattering of nobility in there. They are among the more radical faction. They had lots of ideas. Hébert had a lot of foot soldiers on the ground, and so when he threw in with the Jacobins, he was able to ensure their rise to power by surrounding the convention as it was meeting with some estimated as many as 80,000 sans-culottes who were calling for the Jacobins to rise and who wanted the moderates, you know, not only out of the convention, they wanted them swinging from lampposts. And Palais Duchesne also had a real burr in his bonnet over nobility. Palais de Chaillot got more radical as the revolution went on, but he had never been a big fan of Louis XVI and the profanity and the sexual innuendos that he used with the clergy. He used in abundance toward the king and toward Marie Antoinette. And it didn't help. Marie Antoinette was Austrian, as I had mentioned earlier, and right now France is at war on its eastern borders with Austria, with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, because they want to export the revolution throughout Europe. And most of Europe would really much rather see the king back on the throne in an absolutist monarchy the way everybody else is at this point. And so the mood comes down from, we go from let's have a constitutional monarchy to let's get rid of titles of nobility altogether to let's kill the king. And so on a cold, foggy morning on the 21st of January in 1793, King Louis XVI, I should say the former King Louis XVI, he is now citizen Louis Capet, ascends the scaffold at the Place de la Révolution. There are 20,000 citizens gathered. He turns to them and declares, I die innocent, I pardon my enemies, and I hope my blood will be useful to the French, that it will appease God's anger. And the crowd is just jeering at him. They hate him at this point. They've come for blood, not speeches. You know, the drummers start drumming before he can finish. They strap the king to the plank. They put his head through the guillotine's widow's window and let go the blade. At this point, there's an account from a priest named Henry Essex Edgeworth. He had been Louis' confessor on the ride from the prison to the scaffold. He says, you know, the youngest of the guards, who seemed about 18, immediately seized the head and showed it to the people as he walked round the scaffold. He accompanied this monstrous ceremony with the most atrocious and indecent gestures. At first, an awful silence prevailed. At length, some cries of Vive la République were heard. By degrees, the voices multiplied, and in less than 10 minutes, this cry, 1,000 times repeated, became the universal shout of the multitude, and every hat was in the air. And even before they killed King Louis, the revolutionaries had been setting their sights on God. I guess more specifically, they had been setting their sights on the church. There had been efforts made for several years to reform the clergy. They'd forced some priests to get married. They had emptied the convents. They had forced the priests to sign the civic constitution. As I mentioned earlier, they'd been trying to reform the churches, and they had gotten an awful lot of pushback for this in the more rural regions of France. And so, to fix this problem, the revolutionaries decided on a course of de-Christianization of France. In a November 10, 1793 speech before the convention, one prominent Hébertiste, a man named Anacharsis Clootz. Anacharsis Clootz was actually a Prussian nobleman who had become a radical, I believe, at college. Surprise, surprise, surprise. He was nicknamed the personal enemy of God because of how vehemently he hated Christianity and organized religion. In his speech, he proclaims, "There is no other God but nature. No other sovereign than the human race, the people God. This people is self-sufficient in meeting its own needs. It will forever stand. Nature doesn't kneel. Judge the majesty of the free human race by that of the French people, which is but a fraction of it. Judge the infallibility of all by the sagacity of a portion, which on its own is making the slave world tremble. The more the mass of free men grows, the less will great personages be feared. The subject will disappear with tyrants. Citizens, religion is the greatest obstacle to my utopia." Again, this sounds familiar. Here we are at the edge of a brave new world. We've overthrown oppression, but the oppressors stand outside our gates. The only thing stopping us from a more free, just, and tolerant society are those pesky religious people and their primitive superstitions. And so they started a program to re-educate the French citizens. One of the first things they started doing was wrecking churches. I mean, they broke stained glass windows, defaced statues. They took the gold chalices, silver monstrances. Of course, we don't need these things in a church when the people are starving. They took down crosses in graveyards. They forbade families burying their loved ones from putting a cross above the graveyard, and had painted on the gates of every graveyard, "Death is an eternal sleep." They wanted to make sure the peasants got out of that silly idea that there's an afterlife and that there's a God who judges us in it. Streets and neighborhoods that had been named after saints or had names like Holy Sacrament or Sacred Heart were, of course, renamed to with revolutionary heroes or with ideals. You had to get rid of those offensive religious names and give it a name which is better suited to the public and more in keeping with the times. They even went so far as to get rid of the Gregorian calendar, the calendar which we use today, and replaced it with the revolutionary calendar. The revolutionary calendar had a 10-day week so that you couldn't have a Sunday every 7 days. The Gregorian calendar starts in Anno Domini 1, the year of our Lord 1, the Nativity of Christ, and we couldn't have that. So the revolutionary calendar started on September 22nd, 1792. That was the date the convention had officially abolished the monarchy. So the autumnal equinox of each year would be the beginning of the next year, and 1792 was the year one of the calendar. They were just going out of their way to eradicate any image of Christianity, any Christian vestige they could from this society. They were going to create a secular France, and they really didn't care who they had to kill to do it. Between November 1793 and January of 1794, to pacify the Nantes region, like French revolutionary forces introduced what they called revolutionary baptisms. That was taking prisoners and the accused out into leaky boats in the middle of the river and drowning them in what they called the national bathtub. The number of people killed in these drownings, estimates range between 1,500 and over 6,000. There were also a number of shootings. Thousands of citizens died at Nantes, among them at least 250 priests. One of the charming customs they came up with, the Republican baptism or Republican marriage, was they would strip a priest and a nun naked. They would tie them together, and then they'd give them a baptism or a marriage in the river. Many priests who were not executed were instead deported to French Guiana in South America, to the prison colonies there. You've probably heard of an island off French Guiana where in the 19th century the French also built a penal colony. It's called Devil's Island, and being deported to French Guiana was in effect a death sentence on the installment plan. So that wasn't a huge improvement. Other priests had been forced to leave French territory. They had gone into the empire, some into Spain, anywhere they could really escape being hunted down. And this added even more to the paranoia because, as I said, right now, revolutionary France is at war on its borders, and these priests are escaping. Does that mean that they're coming to organize the armies against us? Whenever you have a lot of internal strife and upheaval, and whenever the social order has been overturned, you're going to have a lot of speculations under pressure. And as I'd mentioned before, you're going to need a target to take out all that negative emotion on. You're going to need somebody to hate. And for a lot of the revolutionaries, that somebody to hate was Catholic clergy and the Catholic Church. Even the constitutional clergy, the clergy who had, against the Pope's orders, signed the civic constitution, who had declared their loyalty to the French state in the revolution, were coming under suspicion because, as I said, you know, there's war on the borders. If we're overthrown, will these priests who signed off promoting liberty in our cause, will they sign off on the Pope's cause? You know, will they sign off on the cause of the emperors? There is a lot of distrust of the clergy amongst the revolution's leaders. There is not so much distrust and hatred of the parish priests among many of the poor. When Jacques Hébert had started putting out La Prairie des Chênes, he had been among that poor. As I'd mentioned earlier, he'd been essentially living in destitution from hand to mouth. With the success of La Prairie des Chênes, Hébert's lifestyle had improved dramatically. He's spending much more time now amongst the bourgeois at the Jacobin Club. He's making the acquaintance of many French aristocrats and nobles and wealthy people, and a circle amongst whom that kind of hard atheism and that kind of gleefully blasphemous attacks on everything sacred were considered to be fashionable. Diderot, who the famous encyclopedist, was famous for saying that he looked forward to the day when the last king was strangled with the guts of the last priest. There was this really militant atheism there, and Hébert starts supporting that enthusiastically in his papers. And the circulation of La Prairie des Chênes begins to drop because a lot of the sans-culottes were, you know, they disliked wealthy priests. You know, they were happy to make vulgar jokes against the church. They didn't necessarily want their churches turned into stables. They didn't necessarily want to see, you know, they wanted a reformed, smaller church. Maybe they weren't particularly devout, but neither did they have any particular hatred toward Jesus, toward the Virgin, or towards God. And in fact, you know, many of them, in fact, considered that blasphemous. And so in an effort to educate these people and give them something they could understand, a suggestion of Anacharsis Cloots, who I'd mentioned earlier, the personal enemy of God, the churches were converted into temples of reason at a November 10, 1793 Festival of Reason. Notre Dame was the site of the biggest of the ceremonies. Over the building's door, they carved the words to philosophy. They destroyed the altar, stole and smashed countless works of art. 28 statues of biblical kings were beheaded. In place of the old altar, they erected an altar to liberty, surrounded by girls in white Roman dress with tricolor sashes, the colors of the Republic. Atop that was a costumed goddess of reason, an opera singer in Notre Dame. She impersonated liberty while a flame burned on the altar to symbolize truth. And while this was intended to enlighten the populace and give them an alternative to religion and superstition, what it actually did was scandalize and galvanize them. Rumors started spreading of prostitutes being put in the place of reason atop altars, of orgies and drunken celebrations held in churches. It's not clear how true these reports were. They may have been exaggerated, but what is important is the people believed it, and the people were outraged. They had absolutely no interest in the cult of reason, no matter how much the state tried to sponsor it. We have an eyewitness account from Gabriel Boutet. He was a French bishop who witnessed the revolution as a teenager. He later became the first bishop of Vincennes, Indiana. He says, "I can still see with my mind's eye the curious processions which they made through the streets of the city on those days, going to the Temple of Reason. They were composed of youths on the Festival of Youth, of hoary men picked up for the purpose on the Festival of Old Age, of husbandmen carrying with them the implements of agriculture on the Festival of Agriculture, of mechanics with their tools on the Days of the Arts. In the month of Fructidor, they had exhibitions of fruits and of the various returns of the harvests in their special times. Now it all seems like a dream, and these exhibitions and processions have a ridiculous effect, as seen through the faint memory of them. Those who had established them supposed that they would accustom the multitude to do without religion, except the religion of nature, as they called it. As each decade came around, they endeavored to make it more attractive by new inventions of pompous shows, or philosophical and sentimental exhibitions, mixing them up with special ovations and songs, civic banquets and public games, copied from the old Greek and Roman republics. The first year and first round of these profane and systematic attempts to root out the Christian religion from the hearts of the people and make them infidels went on with such a continual supply of novelty and interest for the multitude that it made an impression which now it would be difficult to estimate correctly. Even then, however, the effect was often very ridiculous, and as the repetition of each decade proved more forced and tiresome, it became dark and hopeless, as the times were the best mark by which we could measure the slow but certain return of the old and true religion. And the failure of this impious scheme self-defeated, as it proved. The thought, the very memory of these miserable exhibitions has vanished away." Now, not only are the Sans-Culottes not especially impressed with the de-Christianization attempts, many of the Sans-Culottes have noticed that a lot of the church property that was nationalized wound up resold to wealthy landholders and bourgeois. They noticed that shopkeepers and merchants were doing better, while the Sans-Culottes, the working poor, remained largely unemployed, poor, and hungry, and they're starting to get restless about this. And the Jacobins and the Sans-Culottes had never been a particularly good fit. As I'd mentioned, the Jacobins were a bunch of intellectuals, largely bourgeois. The Sans-Culottes were very useful to the Jacobins when they wanted to come to power. Once they were in power, the Sans-Culottes became an increasingly foul-mouthed embarrassment. I mean, sure, at this time, everybody is wearing the Sans-Culottes red Phrygian cap of liberty, as they call it, you know, the liberty bonnet. They are wearing the tricolors, which is the colors of the revolution. They're even wearing pantaloons like Sans-Culottes. But the real Sans-Culottes get increasingly pushed to the wayside by people who really like the idea of the Sans-Culottes, but who really don't have a whole lot of concern for the working poor. And among the people who were growing increasingly fed up with Hébert and with the de-Christianization experiment was Maximilien Robespierre, who, during the Reign of Terror, was the one man you did not want getting fed up with your antics. Robespierre had Hébert, Clutes, and 17 other supporters of the Hébert faction, the Hébertists, rounded up on March 13, 1794. On March 24th, they went to the guillotine. Hébert fainted several times on the way. He screamed as they put his head in the guillotine for what he had called, as Palais Duchesne, asking the time from the fanlight, sneezing into a bag, and trying on Louis Capet's necktie. To entertain the crowd, the executioners dropped the blade and then stopped it a few inches before it hit his head, pulled it up, and then repeated it several times to the sound of shrieks and cheers from an audience that had once loved Hébert but now loathed him, or perhaps was just looking for another bloody spectacle during a time when that was about the only thing the working poor could entertain themselves with. Robespierre felt atheism was a social dead end. He felt that the public needed a form of morality and virtue to be taught, and he believed in a creator. Robespierre was a deist. He thought that the world had been created by a wise, just, and virtuous God, but he believed that after that, God had left the world of the universe to its own devices and had left man with his reason to study the natural laws which ran the universe and the natural moral laws. On May 7th, a few weeks after sending the Hébertists to the guillotine, Robespierre declares a decree of the Supreme Being which is passed by the Convention. That decree states, 1. The French people recognize the existence of the Supreme Being and the immortality of the soul. 2. They recognize that the worship worthy of the Supreme Being is the practice of the duties of man. 3. They place in the first rank of these duties the obligation to detest bad faith and tyranny, to punish tyrants and traitors, to rescue the unfortunate, to respect the weak, to defend the oppressed, and to do good, do to others all the good that one can, and not to be unjust toward anyone. 4. Festivals shall be established to remind man of the thought of the divinity and of the dignity of his being. On June 8th, a month after Robespierre's speech, they had the first festival of the Supreme Being in Paris. This Jacques-Louis David, he's famous today for his painting of Marat in the bathtub, oversaw the organization of the festival, which starts out with speeches and a symbolic ceremony where a statue representing atheism is set alight. From there, there's a procession to the Champ de Mars, where an enormous mountain constructed out of timber and plaster, bedecked with rocks, shrubs, and flowers, illuminated with lights and mirrors, stands. This is a symbol of strength, power, and of Robespierre's faction in the convention, which is called the Montagnards, or the Mountain. Robespierre ascends this mountain dressed in a blue coat, gold trousers, along with the deputies of the convention. He's overlooked by a statue of Hercules, and they sing Les Marseillaise and other revolutionary anthems. The crowd is not especially impressed. Watching the ceremony, Jacques-Alexis Thillot, who had been allied with George Danton, who had gone to the guillotine at Robespierre's orders, says, "Look at the bugger. It's not enough for him to be in charge. He has to be God." And this particular cult of the Supreme Being, this deist cult, only lasted about another 6 weeks, and that's about as long as Robespierre lasted before the Reign of Terror ended with him going to the guillotine. Robespierre's big problem with atheism was he felt it would dissolve the bonds of society by leading people to believe, you know, the fate of everybody is just decided by blind chance and leave people at the mercy of the strongest, the most clever, without that moral code, which that was what he saw as the primary, in fact, the only purpose of religious ceremonies. And to be fair, a lot of people today share that feeling, including many, possibly in America, the majority of people who call themselves Christians. Robespierre is kind of famous for the Reign of Terror. His influence as a theologian has been greatly underestimated. Like medieval philosophers and many French royalists, Robespierre saw the church and the state as working together for the betterment of the people. He saw the benefits to society of religion as well as religion's pitfalls, and so he wanted to create a religion which would help prop up his state the way the church had helped prop up the French nobility. His cult of the supreme being was going to educate the populace the way the church was supposed to educate the populace, only instead of feeding them folly and superstition, it was going to feed them reason and truth. It is not clear whether or not Robespierre was a Freemason. Certainly there were Freemasons in his circles. Many people have noted the idea of the deist creator god, very similar to the Masonic idea of the grand architect and great geometer. I don't really know enough about the Masonic roots of the French Revolution. That is a whole other story. People have written books on the subject. People have written multiple books. That's over my pay grade, so I'm not really going to speculate on where exactly he got that idea from, but it certainly was an idea that was very popular throughout Enlightenment-era Europe. The idea that there was a God who had created this universe and that had created the natural laws under which it runs, but who didn't take a particular personal interest in it. He's much too big to do such a thing, of course. You know, he simply set that there, and he left men to their own devices and provided us reason by which we can live a good moral life and become productive citizens. Perhaps the biggest issue was that his cult of the supreme being was essentially a Bayes cult of reason with God, or more precisely, with a distant creator God who we mention once or twice and then return to focusing on the exact same subjects which the cult of reason had focused on. It wasn't a particularly convincing rebranding, and it didn't really meet the needs of the population. I would also note that in casting himself as the head of this elaborate, gaudy ceremony, Robespierre put himself in a place which would have been more familiar to Louis XIV, the Sun King, and it made people that were suspicious of the connection between church and government, which is to say pretty much everybody in the convention at that time, starts looking askance at Robespierre. And the only thing that Robespierre really managed to accomplish with his cult of the supreme being was getting himself killed. Robespierre recognized innate human morality. He recognized our innate need for religion, but he didn't recognize the force behind that need, the force towards which we point that need, as anything but this distant abstraction. His ceremonies didn't have, you know, what Catholics would call the true presence in the Eucharist. They didn't have the direct connection with divinity and the eternal that you see in Christian ceremonies. And so all they were ever going to be was this sort of hollow mockery of these ceremonies. And when he tried to put them before an audience that had grown up in the true presence, of course, that new religion wasn't going to take hold, because that's not how new religions take hold. Religion is that which binds our temporal self and our temporal existence with the eternal. The crown was intended as something which binds the subjects and their times with the realm's past and with the realm's future. These are signposts on the gate to road to infinity. The church believed for much of its history that monarchy, as a king ruling over his subjects, was a reflection on earth of God ruling over his kingdom of heaven. Robespierre's ceremonies weren't linked to timeless ideals. They were linked to Enlightenment-era ideals. As such, they didn't have a very good chance of surviving past the Enlightenment. That's one of the problems of hitching your star to current events. People frequently say the church needs to get with the times. Ideally, the times are supposed to get with the church. The church is supposed to stand as this banner and this bulwark, you know, pointing you toward the true harbor. When you focus instead on getting a social message across, no matter how laudable that message might be, what happens is you soon start looking dated. I mean, the Jesus freaks of the 60s. I mean, today, how many hippie Christians do you see walking around? How influential was that movement past the 1960s and early 70s? And after Robespierre's demise, several of his admirers decided to combine some of his ideas with one of Robespierre's greatest inspirations, Lousseau, and make a third try at a religious movement aimed at dethroning Christianity. Theophilanthropy had only two basic tenets, a belief in God and an immortal soul. However, it was quick to note that these beliefs were, they call croyances sentimentales, sentimental beliefs. These beliefs are here to maintain public order and individual well-being. Just accept them as a given. Don't think about them too much. It's there for the social order. And here again, we see the focus has gone from on a creator, on the eternal, to mankind. Theophilanthropy is essentially the worship of humanity. And theophilanthropy, good is all that tends to preserve and perfect the man. Evil is all that tends to destroy or impair him. We're not talking about divine commandments here. We're talking about do what's good for you and avoid doing what's bad for you. And theophilanthropy did not lead to a widespread conversion of Christians throughout France. It did not overthrow the order. In fact, it was suppressed in 1800 after Napoleon comes to power. There were a couple of attempts made to revive it. None of them really got off the ground. You can certainly see Robespierre's influence in France today. While a majority of French identify as Roman Catholic, somewhere between 5 and 8% of them attend Mass regularly. The French are notoriously undevout Catholics. There is still a great deal of anti-clerical sentiment left over from the French Revolution. I have a personal hunch. Nothing I could say is proven. I strongly suspect within the next few years, you're going to start seeing a strong rise in the practice of Islam among ethnic French in France. France is such a secular society, and people have gotten so far away from their roots, and there's still so much distrust for the clergy and the church that I strongly suspect that a lot of people in France are going to fill that spiritual void, not by turning back to Catholicism, returning back to the church, or even becoming Huguenots, but by reverting to Islam. Again, this is a hunch, this isn't a prediction, but I would not be at all surprised if this happens. But while I see the influence of Robespierre in France, I see that his basic ideas are a lot more influential than I would like in many American churches. Today, a significant number of Americans who call themselves Christian, maybe the majority of Christian Americans, believe Jesus was an enlightened man whose moral philosophy was the best out of the others that have been put out there. They believe that there is a God, and, you know, there probably is an immortal soul, but really what Christianity is about is doing nice things and being a nice person. And that's essentially the deism Robespierre preached. And yet, despite how much these churches conform to social pressure, how hard they try to keep themselves relevant, they, like the priests and bishops who compromised with the French revolutionaries, are still finding themselves coming under increasing scrutiny. two lessons we can definitely take from the French Revolution is that cooperating with radicals never really works out to your advantage. You cannot cooperate with them. They will only accept total submission. And the second is, when you water down your message to make it more popular, more timely, more contemporary, whatever you want to call it, all you do is make it less effective. And while during the French Revolution the deists came out on top, 120 years later in the 1917 Russian Revolution, the atheists came out on top and have been on a roll ever since. We see many of the same forces in play today that we saw during the French Revolution. We see many of the same ideologies. We see the same divides between religious rural regions and secular urban regions. We see the same efforts by American political leaders to use organized angry mobs as a tool to gain power or to hold on to power. We also see this white-hot, burning hatred of Christianity and all things Christian, this need to deprecate Christianity, this need to present Christianity as the one thing that's holding us back from a brave, tolerant new world. And like the Abaptists, they're in a bubble of their own. Educated, fashionably blasphemous people with their own utopian ideas, and I don't think they understand exactly how angry America's Christian population is getting or how hard they are capable of striking back. And if you're one of those listeners on the other side who has been supporting the ongoing march of globalism, first of all, I have to thank you for having an open mind. Welcome to the show. Feel free to send comments or questions. I will try to respond in future episodes. But secondly, I would ask you to think long and hard about this. Jacques Hébert got lots of money, got lots of political support, was able to get away with all sorts of things while he was useful to wealthy political figures. Today, wealthy political figures are throwing millions, hundreds of millions of dollars at organizations like Black Lives Matter. They are giving their support of Antifa. Do you think that they have any more concern for your well-being than those politicians had for Jacques Hébert's being? And do you think that once you cease to be of value to them, that you're not going to wind up facing the very same fate Jacques Hébert and the rest of his followers got? In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, this has been Notes from the End of Time. Kenaz Filan here with you. Thank you so much once again for listening. Kenaz Filan, signing out.